Today, a closer look at billionaire Jeff Bezos and his Amazon empire. And what is the future for TV news?
Very famously, by the time that he was working on Wall Street, he was lonely, he didn't have a girlfriend, and he started to try to apply the same kind of mindset that he would apply as a deal maker. He started to try to apply that to dating. You know, you have an investment banker who thinks about deal flow, you know, the number of opportunities that come up, keeping that flow going and then making the right choices. He similarly came up with a model that he called woman flow. He had certain standards that each woman needed to meet as far as intelligence and resourcefulness and you know, different characteristics that he was looking for. And he let it be known among his circle, you know, that he was looking to increase his woman flow. Ironically, that, or not ironically, because I think that most people would agree that making a personal relationship is a little bit different than a financial deal. That is not how he actually met his longtime wife.
In fact, Jeff Bezos met his now ex-wife when he was working on Wall Street in 1994, before they moved to Seattle to set up Amazon. A business that would eventually make Bezos the richest man on earth. Buying from Amazon is fast, convenient, cheap, and becoming practically unavoidable. But Amazon's reach doesn't stop at online shopping. From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesson. Today in Focus, should we be worried about Jeff Bezos' Amazon empire? So he liked a system. He liked to see the world in kind of solvable equations.
He has a mind that really looks, I think, to the structure and, you know, kind of the infrastructure of how things work.
Julia Carey Wong has been following the rise of Amazon as a technology reporter for The Guardian US.
So even when he talks about his decision to leave behind a very high-powered job, he doesn't talk about, you know, that he had a dream. He doesn't talk about, you know, taking a risk. He thought about it as a regret minimization framework, as if he himself were a business that he was managing.
I want to have lived my life in such a way that when I'm 80 years old, I've minimized the number of regrets that I have.
The first item that Amazon sold online was books. Do you know why that was? Was it a particular interest to him?
I don't think that he had any particular interest in books. What he has said is that he drew up a list of 20 types of goods that he could get started in.
Because books are incredibly unusual in one respect, and that is that there are more items in the book category than there are items in any other category by far.
But his ambition was always that he would sell everything. Everything that could be sold would be sold on Amazon. And many of these things that he imagined have come true. So he ended up going to Seattle because the major distributors of books had their warehouses in Seattle. So despite Amazon being a, you know, this digital company that's, you know, of the future, the internet, it was also very much from the beginning, he had his eye to the nuts and bolts of what you need to do to physically move goods around the country and understanding that it needed a lot more than just a nice looking website.
And right at the beginning, when Amazon started, it was the kind of sort of legendary tech startup beginning that we all picture, wasn't it?
Exactly. So the business was set up and they ran it out of the garage. Famously, they used a door for a table to hold their computers on. And he realized that it was actually cheaper to buy a door and to buy four pieces of wood and hammer them on and create a table.
It's a symbol of spending money on things that matter to customers and not spending money on things that don't.
It's kind of emblematic of his very kind of frugal approach to what the business should be, you know, to spend all of their money on things that are going to affect the customers, and if it comes to your own employees' personal comfort, those are the places where he's tended to cut corners and be much less willing to splash out. Amazon's philosophy has always been deeply, deeply focused on the customer experience. It's described as being kind of Amazon's North Star, that everything focuses on the customer.
It's not scary, and it's very, very fast.
Amazon.com discounts so many books that even with the shipping, you end up saving money.
It's fun, it's vast, it piques my interest.
He's always had a very long-range vision as a business leader, thinking about things, you know, when he thought about his own decisions, he was thinking on an 80-year time frame as opposed to on a 3-year time frame or a 5-year time frame, you know, the way that most people starting out in their career might think.
For the customer, Amazon only exists on the computer screen. But Bezos does have an office, so we wangled an invitation.
And in 1999, there's this amazing interview with him for 60 Minutes. And it was kind of a first look inside the Amazon offices. He's kind of like sitting there in his messy office with like Amazon.com spray painted on a big sign.
These are, you know, sticky balls.
They're obviously they work.
Chucking like sticky balls at the wall and sort of just like giggling all the time.
Yes, he has a very famous and very kind of particular laugh.
At this point, Amazon's 5 years old. What did the world make of Jeff Bezos at this point?
Many people saw him as just another dreamer. I mean, the number of people that thought that Amazon was just riding for a fall, you know, just kept growing. People just thought that this was crazy, that you would never make money selling books on the internet.
Amazon becomes more than books. It starts selling CDs and it doesn't stop there. What areas does the company start to expand into?
It might be easier to talk about the areas that Amazon hasn't expanded into, because this is a company that has its fingers in almost every aspect of the economy.
I got the latest, greatest music with 24 days to go. A book on Eastern tunics with 23 days to go.
CDs, electronic goods, clothing, home goods, almost anything that you can put in a box and ship.
Thanks to Amazon.com.
I'm sucking down the eggnog with 20 days to go.
And then they started making their own TV shows, making their own movies as a studio. Amazon Web Services has become a massive part of their company. They run the cloud for huge sections of the internet. They have very strong artificial intelligence services. They sell facial recognition products that can be purchased by local police forces. It's hard to think of a product area that Amazon hasn't moved into.
Alexa, what do you do?
I can play music, answer questions, get the news and weather, create to-do lists, and much more.
Awesome. Huh.
Were Amazon's web services to go down, you would find huge numbers of the websites that you might go to on a daily basis simply cease to work. Even Netflix, which is a strong rival of Amazon when it comes to web streaming entertainment, uses Amazon Web Services to host their content. It is undergirding a huge amount of the infrastructure of our economy and increasingly of the US government.
We can see your greedy side.
Amazon, Amazon, you can't hide.
We can see your...
There have recently been protests over Amazon's relationship with US Immigration's Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and the Department of Homeland Security, because Amazon hosts their databases, and some of those allow agencies to track and deport immigrants. They're also in talks at the moment to host biometric data for Homeland Security. That's sensitive personal data, including eye colour and skin markings. So their relationships really do go beyond commercial and into the heart of government.
They manage the cloud services for the CIA, which is some of the most sensitive and important to protect data in the world. They are competing to become the cloud service provider for the entire US Department of Defense.
This arm of Amazon, the cloud computing services, how worried should we be about the control they have?
If they're controlling one third of the world's cloud computing, that is actually less than what they're controlling of the United States e-commerce, which is almost 50%. In both of those cases, it is concerning because that is a massive, massive concentration of power that doesn't really have a counterweight. In the United States, there are signs that our government is starting to look into and investigate whether or not there is an antitrust case to be made against Amazon as far as some of its monopoly power.
So this was the announcement last week that the US government would investigate complaints that tech giants, including Amazon, Facebook, Google, Apple, were squashing out the competition.
Focus of this inquiry will be on the size and might of the firms, how they've expanded their reach into additional businesses, and how they've leveraged the power of having large networks of users.
So and again, it's going to look at their hold on things like advertising, online sales, and cloud computing.
But so far, we haven't really seen regulators and public officials really putting forward a framework to start to reduce this amount of power that they have.
One of the ways Amazon has been able to grow and to expand into so many different areas is through Bezos's business strategy of buying up the competition. And back in 2009, there was the acquisition of the online shoe company Zappos. What happened there?
So Zappos was another up-and-coming e-commerce company when they focused on selling shoes.
Want to put a smile on your feet? Then experience shoe shopping the Zappos way.
Zappos would let you order two pairs in different sizes and then send back the one that didn't fit, which took a lot of the uncertainty out of buying a pair of shoes online for people that grew up going to a shoe store and trying them on first.
Mom, we're not happy with our shoes until you are.
Amazon was struggling to get its own shoe selling organization off the ground. It's been said that they then started to really go after cutting prices. And because Amazon had this great amount of investor backing from Wall Street, it was able to really, really challenge Zappos at that level until the Zappos CEO, it seems, basically said, all right, and he sold Zappos to Amazon.
Amazon spent a lot of money acquiring Zappos. It cost them $900 million in stocks. And they have also, over the years, bought up other companies like Audible in 2009. They bought the video game streaming site Twitch in 2014, Whole Foods in 2017, many more. And these acquisitions haven't always been driven by the need for instant profit.
And that has been one of the things that Amazon has been consistently willing to do, and that Amazon's investors have given it the runway to go for, was, you know, the understanding that if we become monopolists, if we can really own this entire market, we will not be taking losses forever. You know, in the past 4 or 5 years, as the rest of the competition in many cases has fallen away or been acquired or been pushed out of business, we have seen that Amazon's profits have been shooting up.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the stories that come out of the Amazon warehouses, the stories of the conditions for people who work for Amazon, because that's a bit of a controversy inside the business, isn't it?
There has been great amounts of reporting of how these workers are treated as if they are the precursors to automation, while Amazon is still working on perfecting the robots that will eventually replace them. They are constantly timed for every task that they do when it comes to pulling things off the shelves, putting them into the box, and getting those boxes ready to go. They are constantly monitored and tracked at every step.
You had a set time you could go to the bathroom. If you wasn't out of the bathroom within that time period, then they were looking for you.
One of the most disturbing aspects of the New York Times' investigation into Amazon's corporate workplace practices in 2015 was the number of people who said, you know, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, I suffered a miscarriage, my dad got cancer, and very, very quickly felt that they were pushed out.
When Jeff Bezos responded to the New York Times allegations, he said, quote, "The article doesn't describe the Amazon I know." How does he respond to criticisms of the treatment of his workforce?
In the past year or so, Amazon has become more aggressive about pushing back against criticism, especially from elected leaders.
We're seeing this incredibly large company getting involved in almost every area of commerce.
When Senator Sanders started to forcefully criticize Amazon, Bezos did respond, and they did agreed to increase the minimum wage for directly employed warehouse workers to $15 an hour as of November 2018. But for the most part, for many years of Amazon's, they basically just almost ignored the criticism because they knew that it wasn't changing customers' decisions. Even for many kind of progressive, liberal-minded customers who might philosophically know that there is exploitation going on behind the scenes of receiving the toaster oven that you want in 48 hours after you order it, people are still ordering it.
Amazon has also faced criticism for the amount of tax that it pays. In 2018, they made $11.2 billion in profits in the US, but they didn't pay any federal income tax for that year. They maintain that they pay all the taxes they're required to pay in the US and every country where they operate. So what's going on?
Amazon is like any other American corporation, or probably global corporation, in that they do everything that they can to pay the bare minimum that is required of them. Amazon set itself up in Washington State and for years, you know, enjoyed this advantage of not having to pay sales tax for non-Washington State purchases. When they decided that they needed to open a facility on the East Coast, they chose Delaware, which has no state taxes, as opposed to any of the other states on the East Coast where it might have set up and been subject to higher taxes. So they've always, from the beginning, looked to minimize their tax bill. And so that's part of it is Amazon being very intentional. Part of it is also that, you know, the US government has not taken up the challenge to say, actually, we should tax this company more. A large percentage of these workers are actually on forms of federal assistance because they don't make enough money to support themselves and their family. And at the same time, our laws are not requiring Amazon to pay its fair share towards funding those public assistance programs. So it goes both ways, and there's definitely blame to go around.
So on one hand, there's this quite terrifying image of Jeff Bezos as this guy who sees the world in equations. He's a ruthless businessman. He kind of wakes up and eats competitors for breakfast. But then on the other hand, you know, in 2013, he bought the Washington Post. And that feels quite different, doesn't it, to most of his other acquisitions. What happened there? Why did he buy the paper?
Jeff Bezos's purchase of the Washington Post is a strange outlier when you look at the rest of his career. This is the richest man in the world, and he has shown, up until a few years ago, almost no interest in philanthropy. There is a giving pledge among these, you know, incredibly wealthy billionaires that many others, including Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg, have all signed on to, that they will give away at least half of their fortunes by the time that they die. But Jeff Bezos has not. So when he decided to purchase the Washington Post, I don't think anybody really understood what was going on. He was able to buy it for $250 million, which to somebody like Jeff Bezos is probably the equivalent. I was kind of doing the math myself, and I think it might be the equivalent of me as a Guardian reporter buying a new sweater. So it was no money off his back.
A big lunch.
You know, yeah. Maybe splashing out and having a nice cocktail. But by most accounts, he has been a really great steward for this legendary newspaper that, like all newspapers, has had been very much struggling under the new economies of the news business.
I've always believed, and I think a lot of, I know it's not a rare belief, I think a lot of us believe this, that democracy dies in darkness, that certain institutions have a very important role in making sure that there is light. And I think the Washington Post has a seat, an important seat to do that.
It's an interesting and frankly very valuable thing that he's done. And it's also interesting because I do think that it has placed a target on his back towards Donald Trump. To do him credit, it does not seem that Bezos has done anything to put any pressure on that paper to back off in reporting on the Trump administration or generally in reporting on Amazon itself.
We should say that he used his own money to buy the Washington Post. It's not part of Amazon. And he also used his own money to pursue his own big space ambitions with his company Blue Origin, with a view to saving humanity.
When our descendants look to the stars, perhaps from a rocky moon or colonies floating in open space, they'll remember this time.
You might have seen a picture of his rocket. If you haven't, you should. But at the same time, Amazon shareholders recently rejected a proposal from about 8,000 of their employees to create a climate strategy. Why do you think that that's not a priority for Bezos?
Capitalism requires constant growth, right? And the point where we are with the Earth, with climate crisis, with global heating, is a point where we're realizing that there is a limitation on growth. For many of us, this has inspired a look inward to say, what do we need to do to change the economy to make this sustainable? And for some small number of billionaires, there has been a look skyward to say, well, actually, we can continue to grow. We can continue to expand infinitely. Jeff Bezos is not alone in this. There's also, you know, Richard Branson, Elon Musk, other billionaires today that actually this experiment of constant growth with little thought to sustainability, to me, it seems a bit mad because even if we can get some small number of people into space colonies, there's going to be untold suffering on Earth if we don't address the problems here. But again, Jeff Bezos is somebody that takes a very long view.
Knowing what we know about Jeff Bezos now, what do you think his vision is for the future of Amazon?
My personal theory of Amazon is that they are in many ways looking to replace the state and be kind of the primary institution that people interact with on a day-to-day basis. 50% of U.S. households already are members of Amazon Prime, which means that on a monthly basis, half of American households are paying a kind of tax to Amazon, $20 a month, in order to receive the benefits of being kind of citizens of Amazon Nation. And it's really kind of a vision of the world where people are not so much citizens as they are consumers and customers. And Amazon will serve more and more of their needs. They're moving into healthcare. They're moving into insurance. You know, we're kind of at a point where you can start to see that we might be the United States of Amazon as much as we are the United States of America.
Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great talking with you.
We contacted Amazon about this episode. With regards to worker conditions, Amazon said, "It's simply not true to say that Amazon fulfillment centers are unsafe. They say that employees can take short breaks at any time to use the restroom, to drink or snack, and that there are multiple bathrooms and break rooms on every floor." They added, "Amazon announced its $15 minimum wage increase because we wanted to lead on this issue." On the topic of tax, they stated that, "We've paid $2.6 billion in corporate taxes since 2016. We pay every penny we owe." In response to recent protests over the hosting of Homeland Security data, they told us, "We believe strongly companies and government organisations need to use existing and new technology responsibly and lawfully. We remain eager for the government to provide this additional clarity and legislation." They also commented on Jeff Bezos's desk, saying, "Today, the door desk is more a symbol of our humble roots and a reminder of our frugality leadership principle, which reminds us that constraints breed resourcefulness, self-sufficiency, and invention." Coming up, why younger audiences have turned their backs on TV news. Now, young audiences are sitting down in front of the television to watch the news less and less. Jim Waterson is The Guardian's media editor and has been looking at what this might mean for future generations.
A lot of people in the UK still watch TV news. 75% of the population still get some of their news from television. But that figure is falling, and among young people, they've almost entirely deserted the format, which raises all sorts of interesting questions, because the average person aged 65 plus in Britain is watching about 33 minutes of TV news a day. Young people, those aged 16 to 24, are watching between 2 and 3 minutes a day. There's a complete disconnect between these two audiences and how they're consuming the news. Young people aren't watching TV news because they're not watching TV. They're abandoning the format for all but Love Island and a few sporting events. Young people who aren't watching TV bulletins, who aren't tuning into the BBC One 10 o'clock bulletin, are instead increasingly getting it from all manner of places. The main thing is actually in some ways we don't know. We think they're getting it more from WhatsApp, Instagram, even Snapchat. And that is backed out by some of the stats. But the main thing is it's more of an indeterminate access to the internet, with stories just flying around in isolation, one sent by a friend, one from the Guardian app, one from the thing that they just saw an influencer post on Instagram. It results in a very strange media environment for the news because we just don't know a lot of the time what people are consuming. There's a massive disconnect between that group of the population and older viewers who are still stuck in their habits and show no sign of changing. When we talk about the media in this country, we often do it in an odd way where we talk about it as if there's a transition for some audiences to online. That's the sort of thing we were talking about 10 years ago. This has now happened. For a large chunk of the population, the internet is their news source, and that is a thing that politicians have to be aware of in particular. Previously, the target of someone who was working in Number 10 communications was to get on the news at 10 and get their story as the top item and get it presented how they wanted. Now they have to try and reach the same size audience through a disparate number of formats, reaching out to young people through all manner of ways, and that's a lot harder. It requires a lot more thought. And inevitably, that's going to change how politics works, the sort of policies that are chosen, and the messaging around them. And at the moment, they're stuck in the very difficult position of trying to balance the traditional audience, who are still tuning into a bulletin, and trying to reach a younger audience who just aren't. This is going to change society. Politics is reflected through our media, and it shapes the issues, the policies that get highlighted. There's no way back from this. It's happening. It's one of those generational shifts that happens, such as when the first radio stations came along, then the first TV stations. The internet is bigger than all of those in terms of its transformational effect. And we still don't really know where we're going to end up. This is still early days.
That's all for today. My thanks to Jim Waterson and Julia Carey Wong. Do keep us posted on what you think of Today in Focus. We'd love to know. Leave us a review wherever you are listening. Today's programme was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Courtney Youssef and Rosie Gillett. The sound design is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.